Okay, then, welcome back to Persuasion Power. This is part two. Part one dealt with selling the wrong thing, how to make sure that you're selling the right thing, and the fact that it is not the physical attributes or the logic or the metrics of the product, but rather it's the emotion and feeling that the product elicits from people that makes them want to say yes or no, buy or not buy, both in business and in personal interactions. Here are these buttons that I'm going to expose to you that are extraordinarily powerful, and again, I warn you to use them with caution. Buttons you push to persuade people to think and do and be what you want them to think and do and be. This, again, is based upon extractions from the book Persuasion Power, which is also available for you to go through, and the book called The Gentle Power of Getting Yes. This is a sales manual dealing with strictly sales situations for salespeople, whereas Persuasion Power does both. For the salespeople and those who are in non-sales. So, extracting from both of those, I want to talk with you about the motivators that cause people to say yes or no. Psychologists for a long time we have read indicate to us, or have indicated to us, that people are more motivated to move away from pain than to move toward pleasure. That sounds like an interesting thing. What's so important about it? Once you light up about the fact that pain is more powerful a motivator than pleasure, all of a sudden it gives you some choices. The tough things that you want to sell, the hard things that you want to sell, become much easier to sell if you communicate them, if you articulate their outcomes in the context of making the pain go away. Think about the natural human tendency here. We grew up with proverbs like, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. I don't know if you've heard that. We don't want the pain of losing. And now, that piece of insight gives you great influence. Let's talk about this. In the book Persuasion Power, I outline five, now there are six items that have been discovered that cause people the greatest pain in society. I want to go through them and you tell me if one of those causes you any harm or hurt or fear or negative emotion from time to time. Money or lack of it. Job, work, business. Causing pain. Dignity. Right smack in the middle, there's something called dignity or the lack of it, disrespect. Health. Poor health or the fear of having poor health. Time. The pressure and the stress of it. Relationships. This is the sixth one, which is a most profound source of pain. The people who love you have the power to hurt you most. Intentionally or inadvertently. Relationships are a source of pain. Would you agree? So my task for you is to say, which one of those causes you pain from time to time? That's a funny question, isn't it? Because if you're like most people with whom I have this conversation, the normal response is, what do you mean, which one of these? Every single one of these at some point or the other, some of them multiple at the moment, cause me pain. Money, job, dignity or lack of it, health, lack of it, time pressures, relationships. What a pervasive source of pressure and penury and punishment for human beings. Right in the middle of that, there's one that I mentioned before called dignity, which is underrated. The lack of dignity as a source of pain for which people will do almost anything to escape the hurt. These pieces of information are truly remarkable methods by which, or keys by which, you can open the doorway of influencing other people. I want to just touch on the one called dignity because it might not be as intuitive as, say, time with its time pressure. Do you realize that mankind in general is starved for dignity? Particularly in Western societies where we get so busy and we call ourselves to be in the rat race. We behave like rats running on a little maze, on a little grill, and we don't have enough time for each other. We don't show each other enough kindness and patience and love. There is somebody who got this wrong. And if he didn't get it wrong, at least the people who apply his theory get it wrong. Erudite, educated, smart people go to universities and learn about Maslow's hierarchy. And if they want to sound like they're eloquent and highly educated, they will speak about Maslow's hierarchy in polite company and get respect for it. And I stand here to tell you that Maslow's hierarchy is wrong, at least in the application of it, because it presupposes that at the bottom there is a level of need called physiological needs, food and shelter and clothing, and that after that you have levels like safety and security and love and belonging, and then another level of self-esteem and self-actualization. The concept is that people don't really care much about the higher levels until they first have the lower levels satisfied. That is the wrong and opposite and upside down way of looking at human emotions and what makes them sad and happy. Tell me, if a person doesn't have food, shelter, and clothing, are you telling me that safety and security and love and belonging are not equally important to them as if they had food, shelter, and clothing? But this is what Maslow's hierarchy says. To be sure, there is a sort of practical application of this where if a man is starving, needs food and drink, it doesn't behoove you to go and tell the man to put on his shirt or to clean up his clothing because the man is at a point of survival need. So the way the person looks may not be the need that you take care of. Yeah, you need to give the man some bread if he's hungry. But you don't need a sophisticated sociological theory for that. That's just practical stuff. As a theory, it is wrong because it has put human needs in a sequence where it says that the more basic needs are more important to be fulfilled before you ever get concerned about the others. It is absolutely backwards. The truth of the matter is, if you were to walk into a neighborhood, an inner city neighborhood, where people, young men, 20, 25 years old, are sitting around on a Monday morning at 10 o'clock when most other young men of that age are at work, and you should go into that neighborhood and insult their dignity, I'd like you to go do that and come back and tell me what happens. You go there, you insult their dignity because you think until they get their needs satisfied of food, shelter, clothing, safety, and security, living in dangerous neighborhoods, they don't really care about respect and dignity and self-esteem. What would happen? At this point, my audiences usually chuckle and say, you would not come back. At least you didn't come back the way you went in. And I agree with that. Because you see, for these young people who don't have what it takes to fulfill the lower needs, the need for the higher orders to be fulfilled is heightened. It's even greater. You see, when somebody has money and can move with polite company and can go to Paris for vacation once every couple of years or so, if somebody were to mess with that person's dignity, yeah, it wouldn't be as bad. In other words, the person could get over it, yeah? But you see, when you can't take care of your food, shelter, and clothing, when you are in a place where you're at the very basic levels of human survival, and you don't have the physical things to show, it is in those places where dignity and esteem and respect become even more important, as opposed to less important because you have not yet fulfilled the lower needs. And now, just in case you think I'm picking on Maslow, because something is so clearly wrong, I want to give you another source. I want to take you to 1976. Wahba and Bridgewell Publication says, quote, "It has since become one of the most popular and often cited theories of human motivation." Period. An interesting phenomenon related to Maslow's work is that in spite of a lack of evidence to support his hierarchy, comma, it enjoys wide acceptance, period. Close quotation. You see, it's not me alone. He made it up. Without any data, he made it up. And then in 1995, Soper, Milford, and Rosenthal also came to the same conclusion that Maslow had no basis at all for this thing. So when you start talking about people who don't have it, who are at the lower levels of socioeconomic scale, and you think that the first thing that you need to do is to feed them, then you make a mistake. You need to build their dignity. You need to give them a sense of belief in themselves, if that is possible for you to do. And that sense of belief and dignity will cause them to hunger to go find skills to work. Help them, certainly. Give them money when they're hungry, perhaps. But importantly, give them money to learn how to fish, not just to wait on you. If someone is hungry for money and you should come up and talk about how bad that feels and what the hurt is like, and the lack of, again, dignity from not being able to pay for all the bills and so forth, and then do that sensitively and gently, then you have that person's ear so that down the road, if you should have a solution, that person would want to move toward you because you understand the pain from which he is trying to escape or she's trying to escape. If you talk about the pain and problems of the workplace and you can identify with that person and empathize with that person will more likely want to listen to you. Health, if you talk about the implications of not having health, of being worried about family health and so forth, that person is more likely to want to listen to you. And so herein lies great secrets for reaching the human thinking, heart, and motivation to perform. So this section is called The Buttons You Push to Persuade. And we've just covered six of them. If you just listen for the pain and figure out how to append what you have as ways of making that pain go away, then you're going to be much more successful at selling what you have. So I, for example, I'm working with a bank in the Caribbean, one of the largest banks in the Caribbean, and I go up to the front of the room and write on the board what we sell. And I ask the group to tell me what this bank sells. And they tell me things like credit cards, loans, mortgages, different financial instruments like investments and so forth. And then I turn to them and I say, you are leaving money on the table. You're not making the kind of money that you should be making selling these things because you are selling the wrong things. You're pushing the wrong buttons when you talk about these things. People do not want loans because that means they have an obligation to pay back in the future, and that's painful. People do not want credit cards because credit cards obligate them to pay back. People don't want to deposit their money with you. They want to have the money themselves. But what they really want is they want security. They want increased safety. They want to have their wealth grow. They want to have a sense of confidence that their children are going to be taken care of later on. Push the emotional buttons that have to do with their financial state, their emotional state, their care for their families, and so forth. Here is another button that I want to tell you about that is intertwined with the others, but is sufficiently distinct that I want to isolate it. It's called listening. I don't mean being quiet. I mean listening empathetically and understanding the person's feelings to give that person a sense of importance and dignity, here's the word again, that somebody's interested in his life or her life. I learned a technique about listening once, and I decided to try it. So I took a plane from some city to some city, and when I got into the plane, there was a gentleman who was sitting in the window seat, and I was sitting in the aisle seat. Using the normal airplane protocol, you don't begin to chat up with people because they may not want to talk with you. I kind of nodded at him and said, hi, how are you doing? He said, hey, fine. And we sat down, and a little while after, the plane took off, and I said, nice weather, huh? He said, yeah, nice weather, pretty nice out there. I was testing to see if he wanted to talk to me. And he seemed to be open. So a little while later, I said to him, I asked him, so are you going to, I don't know, Philadelphia? Do you live in Philadelphia, or are you going there on business? And he said, no, as a matter of fact, I live in Philadelphia. I said, oh, great, tell me about Philadelphia. And he did. And he told me a good amount about Philadelphia. And I said, so do you have a family there? Oh, yes, he said. And he told me about his two daughters and his wife. And he told me, and he told me, and he told me. I just kept digging and digging and digging, nicely, gently, and showing, really? Interesting. Every time he asked about me, I gave him a quick answer and repeated my questioning about him. I didn't tell him much about myself. And I learned so much about him just by being interested. Now, that's not the really good part of the story. We got to the city, and we both got up after the plane had landed and reached for our luggage in the compartment above us. At that point, this gentleman put his hand in his pocket, took out his card, and he shook my hand and he said, it was so great to talk with you. You're such an interesting person. Let's stay in touch. You can imagine what went through my mind. I thought, you've got to be kidding me. This thing really works? The man did not know anything about me other than maybe my first name and that I was a management consultant. Because I deliberately tried not to give him anything at all about myself. And I knew almost everything I could find out about a person in a day and a week. And yet he thought me interesting, even though he didn't know me. This is where I coined the term. If you are more interested, people will find you more interesting. Do you want to make more money in your career? Do you want people to like you? Do you want to have a greater reputation? Then stop being so interesting and become more interested. You may want to write that down. The button that we're talking about is authentic and genuine and patient interest in other people. In the world of the rat race, here you are with patience and kindness, not promoting yourself. You're not doing like I do sometimes, where when somebody talks to me and says something, in the middle of that sentence, I'm already formulating a response, and then I lose the other half of the sentence. No, you are now going to this with a calm assurance that it's okay not to push yourself forward to get into that person's world. When you get there, doors begin to open. Here's this gentleman taking out his card. Imagine that I was a salesman selling insurance, and I never talked about insurance at all. And at the end of this trip, the man says, you're a very interesting person, and gives me his card. Do you think I'd be in a better place to call him up a couple of days or a week later and get him into a conversation about insurance? Betcha. Why? Because I showed interest in him. We're talking about selling here. We're talking about persuasion. Let me give you an example of something that happened that put this to the test. I taught this to the same bank in the Caribbean, and I gave them a charge to go back to their branches and choose somebody who might walk into the branch and just show genuine interest. Stop talking about selling credit cards and getting bank accounts open and trying to give them loans. Show genuine interest in somebody and let me know what happens. And the results have been really amazing. I got a call, actually I called the branch and one of my students was in the branch and he lit up when he heard that it was me. He said, Mr. Day, I can't believe it worked. I said, who is this? Let's say his name was William. He said, my name is William. Remember, I was standing by the counter in the training session that you did 2 weeks ago. I was the one standing right by the grill at the counter there. I said, yes, I remember you, William. I remember exactly who he was. He said, I went back to my branch, and the day after the training, I saw an older lady who was sitting waiting to be served. I went and I sat beside her, dressed in my bank outfit, and I welcomed her to the bank and asked her what brought her to this branch. And she told me she lived close by. I said, okay, so have you been living here long? I've never seen you in this branch. And I found out about her daughters and her family and what brought her to the bank and so forth as she waited for her time to come up for this special service that she wanted. And I wished her well at the end of this and never once said a thing to her about business. He said the day after that, I got a call from this woman who reminded me who she was and said, I work for a boss who needs to buy a new fleet of trucks and I want you to be the one who finances these. And she gave me $6 million worth of business for that and for the boss who wanted an SUV as well. And then he said, a week later, she called me up and gave me a referral to somebody. He made $6 million worth of business there. And he said, Mr. Day, I never asked her for anything. I never asked her for any business. He said, never thought it would work. So I wrote up a one-page report and sent it to the CEO and gave him a little light, a little exposure, put his name on it, and had the CEO write attaboy and send it back to him. That's the way I work, to get your people a little bit of encouragement to put the thing into practice. Now, I must admit to you that if you're in a sales business, you can't go about your sales work never asking people about the business. That's not the point of all this. The point of all this was to do something dramatic just to prove the theory so that you can move it from theory to actual practical strategy. In your sales business, you definitely have to be in people's faces telling them about things and closing and asking them to take the sale. But if you should show interest before you show your product or your service, people will find you interesting and therefore be more open to your product. Not leading with what you want, but talking about what the customer wants or the client wants. I have another application to share with you. If you are not in the sales business, you might ask, okay, so how do I use this? I don't go to sales training, and this is helpful, but what do I do with this? As I said before, you may be negotiating to buy a car, or you may be going into a business asking the business to make a difference or an exception for you in the policy and do something. And if you know these processes, you can be well on your way to getting the yes that you want. Here's a story that I regard as just amazing. When we lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I was working at P&G, I bought the most expensive pair of shoes I found in the mall store at Eastgate Mall. I think it must have been $125. It's been many years. And within a month, I noticed that the heel on one of the shoes was worn down, starting to wear down noticeably. And I thought, this doesn't make any sense. This is a very expensive pair of shoes. If it's gone down this far in a month, I'm not going to be able to keep this pair of shoes very long. And I said, with my brilliant idiocy, I assume things to be possible that make many people run the opposite direction. Sensible people. I'm going to take them back. My wife said, you can't take back shoes after you've worn them down. And I said, what's the worst thing that could happen? I get to keep the status quo as it is. So she and I got in a car. I drove her to Eastgate Mall, and I can see it now. We walked into the eastern side of the Eastgate Mall, walked through the doors, and the store that I wanted was at the end of that first passageway before we got into the big open space where all the other aisles took off. As we walked up to the open area on the right, the last store on the right side of that walk-in was the shoe store from which I bought the spare shoes. My wife saw me turn right and she said to me, I don't want to see this. And she went left because she didn't want to be embarrassed. I don't blame her. And so, with a big smile, I walked into the store and I said, good evening. And the young lady at the counter said, hi, good evening, sir. How are you? I said, I'm doing fine. How are you? She said, great. How can I help you? I said, my name's Alvin. What's your name? She said, my name's Betty. I said, hi, Betty. She said, what seems to be the problem? I said, I don't have a problem, just something with which I need your help. See, I bought these shoes here 30 days ago, whatever the number was, here's my receipt. And they were the most expensive shoes. Yeah, those over there are actually the same brand. And honestly, I don't wear them to do anything except to go to work in the morning and come back home. And I work in an office. So I'm seated a lot of the day. And I've noticed that within this short period, this right heel has worn down like halfway. So I figure that this is so abnormal for expensive shoes that something must be wrong with this particular pair. And so I'm asking you a favor if you would consider taking them back and letting me get another pair. She said, I'm so sorry, sir, but our policy is that we do not take back shoes after they've been worn. Okay, that's totally expected. So I said, I understand, Betty. But the reason I'm here is, while I know that that's a normal policy, I'm just asking you for a good customer who wants to be a loyal customer who keeps coming back, would you make an exception and just do it this once? You get to send it back to the manufacturer anyway. I know how that works. She said, sir, I'm so sorry. We can't do that. And I tried two or three different times, different ways, and she said, I'm so sorry, sir, we can't. I said, okay, great. I don't want to get you into any trouble because I may be asking for you to do something that you're not authorized to do. I said, where's the manager for this store? She kind of looked puzzled. Yeah, I said, where's the manager working today for this store? Because I know there's a chain of them. And she said, the manager is at the Tri-County Mall. And I said, would you do me a favor? Can I talk to the manager? She said, well, the manager is going to tell you exactly the same thing that I just told you. And so I said to her, yeah, I understand. I promise you this. If the manager tells me exactly the same thing, to shut up and go away because it's impossible, I'm going to do that. I won't even complain. You'll get rid of me. So with that kind of promise, I guess, she kind of begrudgingly picked up the phone, dialed Tri-County, and asked for the manager, Angie. And she eventually got Angie on the phone and started telling Angie what was happening. And I put up my hand in front of her and said, got her attention. Do you mind if I talk to her? But I was right up in her face and she had no choice but to say to Angie, Angie, the customer wants to talk to you. And by that time, the phone was in my hand. You know, she kind of gave it to me because I was so close to her. She gave the phone to me and I said, hello, good evening. She said, hi, good evening, sir. I said, are you Angie? I heard your name used. She said, yes, I'm Angie. I said, my name is Alvin. How are you, Angie? She said, I'm very well, sir. What seems to be the problem? I said, there's no problem at all. I just happened to have bought this pair of shoes and I went back over the story that I had told to Betty. And she said, sir, I'm so sorry, but our policy is that we cannot take back shoes. Betty is right. We can't take them back after they have been worn. And I said, yes, I know. And I realize that this is the normal policy. And I'm so happy that you were able to take my call, because I think if anybody has the authority to make an exception to that rule, it's certainly not going to be for me to put Betty in trouble to do something against policy. But I know that you can do this if you choose to. And I really appreciate your taking the call. She said, yes, sir, I know, and I'm glad that you appreciate it, but I just can't do anything for you. And I said, Angie, no, you're right. I'm just operating on a wish and a prayer here. If you should tell me to shut up and get out of the store because it's stupid for me to come with such a request, I'm going to do that, and I will not even complain. I will not give Betty any trouble. I will just go home. She says, sir, we don't handle our customers like that. Not at all. And she had a smile in her voice. And then she paused, and she said, is Betty still there? And I said, yeah. And she said, may I speak with her, please? I did everything that I could to prevent myself from saying, yeah, I got her. I knew it. I knew that moment when her mind changed to start looking about how she could help me. Well, the rest of the story goes like this. I said, Betty, Angie wants to talk with you. And Betty looked a little confused. She came, she took the phone from me, and she stood there for about 30 seconds. I don't know what the exchange was. But then I noticed that her facial expression began to get kind of cross. She looked sort of mad. And at the end of that brief conversation, she grabbed the receipt that I had laid on the counter. She punched the keys to the machine really hard. The door flew open, and she counted out an exact amount of change and slapped it down on the desk in front of me, shoved it toward me, turned around, and started fixing the shoes. And I said, thank you so much, Betty. Have a good evening. She did not respond. She gave me the back of her shoulders and just kept fixing the shoes on the nearby rack. I then took my money, stepped out into the hallway, and said, now, where do I find Grace? And I went on the hunt to tell her what happened. By the way, you need to go to the book Persuasion Power and go see this story, because it's documented in all of its detail. This true story is in the chapter called Ask and You Shall Receive. And it is chapter number what? Chapter 6. Because there are some amazing strategies in that story. Now, I must confess to you that I am no brilliant salesperson. I just have been studying this stuff for a while. I'm not the best salesperson I know. I just know how to analyze and depict and draw up the process as I observe it. Many of these strategies, I did not know them. I just sort of was trying hard and happened to hit upon something that worked at the moment. And then I have taught them afterwards and seen them work repeatedly in other selling situations. So it's one of those sort of fortuitous human relationships things that I have been able to step back and model and found that somehow or the other, I hit upon something amazing about human beings. All kinds of lessons in this book in chapter 6. You need to go read them. Emotional balancing act is one of them. I had to be careful in dealing with the emotions of the two people. First, Betty. I couldn't get Betty so mad at me at the start that she wouldn't let me get to the second part. At the end, she was mad because I succeeded. But I had to be very careful about how I touched her emotions there. So I made her a promise that she couldn't refuse, was another one of those strategies. If I get a big no from the boss, I'll be gone. Here's another principle. Don't let anybody do your talking for you when you're selling. If I had allowed Betty to tell Angie her version of the story, Angie would have turned me down without even having to talk to me. Because you see, Betty doesn't believe in it, I do. So I did everything that I could to be the one announcing the story, not depending on a third party. Do not let anybody else tell the story. You find yourself there, you get on the phone, you get into the office, because you can convey what the third party person cannot convey. All kinds of lessons. Here's another one I call the vulnerability strategy. It is perhaps the most powerful of all these strategies that I have repeatedly taught and used and seen to work wonders. From getting a policeman to wish you well after he pulled you over for a speeding ticket, which I've seen repeatedly, to having a woman whose boss was about to fire her walk around the building and tell everybody that she's a wonderful employee. I'm talking about real life scenarios, and what's responsible for that is the vulnerability strategy. Now, going into the depths of the vulnerability strategy is beyond the call and the duty of this particular program. It's just that that's one of the strategies that we use. Here's how I used it, and it's only a small piece again. When I said to Angie, Angie, frankly, I'm really grateful that you took the call. And if you should tell me to shut up and get out of the store because it's a stupid thing to even come in thinking that you could possibly take the shoes back. The emotional mechanisms at work there were much greater than I even thought at the moment. Now, based upon my building a model and seeing it work after that. Let me just do a quick touch on this. You see, Angie's training for customers did not include this. Angie was taught how to deal with belligerent customers, customers with complaints and issues. They never taught her how to deal with a customer who took 100% of the blame. Not only did I take 100% of the blame, but I gave her power. I gave her the power to crush me. And she never saw herself as the kind of person who would crush me. So her natural human instinct was to back away and not crush me. I am talking about the ability for you to rob people of the pleasure of saying no to you. Good Lord, this is so exciting. Okay? I wish you and I were in a room for me to tell you more. I can't do it right now. But this device, of which this is a small example, takes away the pleasure of people saying no to you because you give them the power and you vicariously get under the weight of that power and show them the hurt and the embarrassment with which you would be satisfied if they should use that power. When she was put in that position, she had no place to go except to prove to herself that she's not the kind of person who tells someone to shut up and get out of the store. There's another strategy there that says when you want somebody to do something on the phone with you or spend more time with you trying to solve a problem, when it seems like you've had the person for a long time, inject gratefulness. Just stop them in the middle and say, oh, by the way, I really appreciate your help. You're such a kind person. Most people I talk with would not even spend the time on the phone with me. What is the person going to say? Oh, you're most welcome, sir. It's not a problem. At that moment, you will have bought yourself another 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever the case may be, injecting gratefulness. And then, of course, the all or nothing. The all or nothing says, if this doesn't work, you get rid of me completely. It's over, Karen. That way, Karen sees a benefit for her to do that which you want to do, which is unlikely for her to have done for anybody else. She runs the store and you get her to pick up the phone to talk to the boss when it wasn't necessary. And so it was the promise of all or nothing that made her do that. So anyway, what am I saying to you? I'm saying, I just barely touch them because we don't have the time in this audio to do a fair job of it. But I think you're getting a little sense of the internal mental and psychological mechanisms that influence people when they have to make decisions for or against a notion, and how when you're able to master it in your thoughts and your communication, you can shift people who would otherwise not do what you want them to do. And that's why I say it can get so powerful that you must be careful not to use it for negative ends and be manipulative. In this case, as in the case of the policeman in Toronto, the two policemen in Jamaica, and another one of my readers told me that he had it happen to, how they used the vulnerability strategy, for example, to get the policeman to wish him well and not give him a ticket, how I personally used it in Toronto, Canada. You'll want to learn some more about this. But the bottom line of this chapter is ask and you shall receive. Ask how? Ask in a way that is so compelling and so easy and softly persuasive that the person whom you're asking has no pleasurable outcome other than to say yes to you. And so the last piece that I want to give you in this segment is for you to take your life and the things that you want when you want people to help you and ask yourself the question, how can I position what I have so that people will want to help me? How can I get into the mind of people so that they won't feel resistance? In the next section, I'm going to talk about the process of constructing such a presentation, but begin to think about it already. And if you represent a product or service, think about how the products make people feel when they think about the product, see the product, use the product, interact with the product, talk about the product, and remember that feelings have much to do with it. And among the feelings, the greatest of them is the ones that cause pain. Because if you can append the benefits of your products, the outcomes of your product, to the making of that pain to go away, the amelioration of that pain, the reduction of that pain, then people are much more likely to want it, the thing that you sell. And one critical way to get them to open up to you is to listen with great intention, with empathy, and let them tell their story. Because then you're going to find the hooks onto which you can attach your products that will bring them the pleasure that they need to escape the pain that they feel, the money pain, the job pain, the dignity pain, lack of it, the health pain, the time pain, the relationship pains from which everybody in society, one time or another, suffers. Find something in this to go do right away. And I'll see you in the third segment.